chair here so I can have my book somewhere. And is Max still here? I think he slipped away, didn't he? I have to thank him for his comment about innovation. And he asked you all if you were innovators. Well, when I was a division chief, I had five colleagues. There was one colleague in particular who was always on my tail. I mean, if I moved in a new direction, he was right there. I moved in another direction, right there. I only learned years after leaving that he thought I was the most innovative manager they had. So, different ways to discover if you're innovative. Not necessarily the way you want to. All right. I have interviewed about 50 people around the world from all socioeconomic levels, carpenters, economists, medical doctors, students, manufacturers, actors, from age 17 to 82. And from those conversations, I asked them how they learned, how they kept themselves current. How many of you here feel that you keep yourself current today? Outstanding! I am totally impressed. Because none of the people I interviewed felt that they could keep themselves current. They said, "You're kidding, Madeline. I can't keep myself current." There's like 2.5 million emails a second. There's 300,000 new titles published every year. There's 24,000 magazines. And that's just the old stuff. We're not talking Twitter and Facebook, et cetera, right? They said, "I can't stay current. I try to stay fresh." Which is why my book is called Riding the Current. Because that's all you can do is ride it. And I can't give you the copy. This is the, what do they call it, the proof copy? This is it, the galley proof. That's what it's called. I'm very excited about this. This is like having a new baby. It really is. Okay. And there's a brochure outside if you want to have more information on that. But I'm not going to talk specifically about the book. See Mary sneaking up. What I want to talk about are the principles that underpin this book. Now, I want to tell you that I learned these principles by writing the book. Because writing is one of the most powerful ways to learn. Okay. And I call them, in a kind of an umbrella, radical learning. Now, the first aspect of radical learning is that it is social. Now, we heard a lot of stories today about really great people. I'm going to tell you stories of ordinary and extraordinary people. Ordinary people who became extraordinary. Bob Sadler is a management consultant out in California. He's very famous out there. He works a lot in Silicon Valley. And when I talked with him, I was astounded. He knew everything in management theory. He was right up to date. And I said, "Bob, this is phenomenal. How do you spend all this time to read all those books on management? I mean, this one's just one out of..." Any of you who have to keep up with this field know. Mm-hmm. Your reading list gets to be 6 feet long. Mm-hmm. And he said, "Madeline, I don't read them." I said, "Bob, you're lying to me." He said, "No, I don't read them." I said, "Well, how do you learn this? It's obvious you understand management theory." He said, "Well, over the last 20 years, Madeline, I've developed a group of people around the country. We talk regularly. They read the books." He said, "They tell me what they're reading. They tell me what they're doing in their clients, what they're trying now, what the clients are saying, what they're reacting." I said, "Well, that's a little unfair. Isn't it, Bob?" He said, He says, no. He says, I tell them about what's happening in the trends of the world that I work in. So it's back and forth. And I tell them when I'm doing it, my clients too. So what he's done is he's found this clever way of not reading the material. And I said, but you must read something, Bob. And he said, oh, yes. He said, I read good fiction. I said, good fiction? What do you mean good fiction? He said, why good fiction? He said, because in good fiction, you get insight into human interaction. You see it in the conversation in those stories. And I thought, how brilliant. Here is a man who uses conversation naturally as his learning tool, and he does it even through fiction. So the first principle that I discovered was what I call conversation principle. And it upholds the social aspect of radical learning. That when I learn, you learn. When you learn, I learn. The second piece of the social is that you need to have an environment that really encourages that give and take, that you feel comfortable about that. Now, I'll give you some statistics. Functional, and this is from psychology. Functional people, well, let me back up. We all say things to ourselves, right? You're at the computer and you go, that one? Come on, slow down. Or, oh, that sentence is really cool. You know, you talk to yourself, right? I do. Well, for functional people, you give yourself 70 more attagirls or attaboys for every 100 statements, 100 negative statements. So for every 100 times you tell yourself, we're stupid that way, 170 times you say yourself, brilliant. That's psychology. For those people who are dysfunctional, for every time they say a not positive thing about themselves, they say 114 comments negative. So notice that many fewer negative comments depress you versus uplift you. Think of that when you go into a conversation with someone. Is it an uplifting conversation? Are they telling you? Are they reinforcing what you know? Encouraging you? That's what I call the 5-for-1 principle. And those are the two principles I discovered as I thought about the social aspect of radical learning. The second characteristic of radical learning is that it's sticky. Okay, I got it from a book. You know that. But nonetheless, it's true. It means that when you learn the lesson, you remember it. How does that happen? Well, let's come back to the conversation principle. In conversation, very often, the person will say to you, you know, that reminds me, and they'll tell you the story. Tell you an example. And that's what you remember, especially if it relates to you. And obviously, if you're in conversation, it's going to relate to you because it's the topic of the conversation. So the conversation principle is actually supporting this sticky aspect. The second principle, however, is a little different. Requires a little attention of your mind. Howard Milner is the former opera singer, world famous. And about 15 years ago, he decided that he didn't like the way he had been taught how to sing, and he was going to teach other people how to sing the way he wanted to be taught how to sing. And today, he is a very famous voice coach in London. People fly in from New York regularly to work with him. And he said, it's about observing, hearing, experiencing what your students come up with, working out where they are, and then moving them forward. Get this. I want them to throw away everything they've learned. Now, I can tell you, if you get to Harold, you've already studied at least 10 years, right? I want them to throw away everything they have learned and just start again with listening to themselves. Dana Hawes is an artist, and she will tell you that she's an artist. She also just happens to have a PhD in conflict resolution. Fabulous. And she described one time when she was in a meeting in Afghanistan. And she was with the State Department person, herself, she was on the team. And they would go into these negotiations and discussions, and they'd go back to the hotel to review what was going on. And she said that her colleague would write down every word and go over every word, and she thought every word was what would happen. And Dana would say, "Yeah, but didn't you notice how he sat back at the moment he said that? Didn't you notice that he turned slightly away from you as he said that?" She saw all of the nonverbal. Her colleague, unfortunately, never understood that observation was part of listening to the other and learning what was really happening. So the other principle of sticky is observation. You've got to see it. And I always like to remind people that there's this wonderful thing called after-action reuse in the Army. Does anybody here not know what those are?
Good.
You don't? After a particular activity, the group, the team gets together and they talk about how it works. It works, it works. So they have a really great way to learn from each other. I think it's a great tool, fantastic tool. I would challenge every one of you to do an after-action review of yourself. Okay, I'm going to do that. I'm going to go sit in the corner sometime between today and tomorrow, say, "Okay, Nala, how did you do?" And I'm going to learn from that. I'm going to observe myself after the fact. My challenge is that. Now, one of the fun ones. Another characteristic of radical learning is what I call fuel additions. Raymond Doherty is from Northern Ireland. Many years ago, he tried to commit suicide. Now, the good news is Raymond was unsuccessful. And that's very good for Raymond. And you're going to learn why it's very good for us, too. Because after that attempt, he had some time to himself because he was in a rehabilitation program. And he said one of the things they had there was a shop. And I could, a woodworking shop. And he went in there and he decided, "I am going to learn about wood. I've got the time, I'm going to learn." He, as he described it to me, he said, "I cut it, I sawed it, I sanded it, I glued it, I molded it, I twisted it, I contorted it, I just carved it, I did everything you could do to wood." Today, I don't care if Raymond's making you a three-legged stool or he's refurbishing your entire house. You have complete confidence because this man knows wood because he made a choice. Choice energizes us. It always energizes us. So fuel efficient. You make the choice to learn. And by the way, you don't learn unless you decide to. I'm sorry. You really don't. That's why kids have this problem. So it energizes you. It becomes your energy. Fuel efficient. Okay. The last characteristic of radical learning. This is the one I like the most. It's guilt-free. Guilt-free. Kathy Clark got her law degree at 39. She's in California. In California, as in most states, probably all states, you have to pass the bar before you become a lawyer. Kathy made a decision that when she went to the class that prepares you for a law for the passing the bar, and it's a special class, by the way, it's 4 hours a day, 4 days a week, for 8 weeks. Okay. It's a big deal. She said, "I decided not to take any notes." I was pretty impressed with that. She said, "But the people around her were really concerned for her." I mean, graduate school after a period of time, and so I was always the oldest one in the class, and really worried about the public. All the young people were worried about me. Well, all of her younger friends were worried about her. Kathy's 39. Okay. Okay. And it's just normal, I think. What can I say? But it turned out that Kathy was right. She not only passed the law exam, she passed it the first time. If there are any lawyers here, you know you don't always pass it the first time. And in fact, in California, only 70% of the people pass it the first time. I said, okay, Kathy, you have to tell me the secret. What was it about being there and not taking notes that worked for you? She said, well, I'll tell you how it is. I had studied the law. I knew the law. So when I heard something, I thought, oh, that goes there. Oh, yeah, yeah, so that goes there. There, there. She had a framework in which she put all those lessons. She also did the observation principle. She said, I also spent some time in reflection. I thought about what they were saying. I applied it to different scenarios. But the key was that she had a container for this. She knew where those lessons were going to be. And they could hold her. She set boundaries for herself. It was going to be the law. And that was her limit. And the boundary principle is a really important principle. It actually supports fuel efficient as well, because let's face it, you can't know everything. And you probably have decided, most of you, that you're not going to study and know about string theory. Or, well, there might be an exception up front. Or breastfeeding. Or bookbinding. I mean, there's topics that you're just never going to know about. Okay? So you relax and you say, I don't have to worry about this. I don't have to feel any guilt about this. Well, that's what Kathy was doing. Not worry about all that other stuff and focus right here. Now, some people have said to me, oh, the boundaries are limiting. Limiting. And I say, no, it gives you freedom. Freedom to work within you. Absolutely. But the other principle that supports the guilt-free is the one I absolutely love. I was talking with Ralph Sorcer. Now, Ralph is a famous scientist, and if you haven't heard his name, literally worldwide, it's because his area is the genetics of fruit trees. Okay. And I talked to him about how he keeps himself current. I mean, scientists have a real problem. There are papers that keep crossing your desk, right? Okay, his first trick was, he said, I read 90% of the title. That tells me what's in the paper. I read 50% of the abstract. He said, yes, and then I read 10% of the discussion, and he said, that's it. I said, you never read the whole paper? He said, no, you don't have to. You know what it's about? The abstract gives you the essence, and you go to the discussion because that's where the meat is. Okay? So he's already set some boundaries in what he reads, but he's done it very efficiently. But why am I telling you about Ralph? Because I said to him, Art, in scientific fields, you're always looking at evidence of what's truth or not. I said, I know there are times, Ralph, when fact A over here has all the evidence, it's reasonable, it's true. Fact B over here has all the evidence. It's reasonable, it's true. A and B are in conflict. Mm-hmm. Okay, what do you do with that paradox? He said, a little smile came across the face. He said, that's when I go somewhere in between. He said, the truth probably lies there. And I love that image. Especially for scientists, where you know, cut and dry, right? Objective. Pedro Caruino is a thoracic surgeon. And he recently spent a year sabbatical here in the States. And he is trying to work with machines as they're doing surgeries. And he was trying to learn more. And so he would go to the library and he wouldn't look with thoracic issues. He wouldn't look at the most current stuff. He went over here and he looked at kidney stuff. He said because 30 years ago they were struggling with the same problem in the kidney area as I'm trying to solve in the thoracic area. So I read the old book to see what they were thinking about and how they overcame those things. He dove into a totally different area. And he said, I got enormous insights that guided me as I went to what I was looking at. The tragedy is that the librarians ran out of room that year, and so they took all the old books and put them in another section. And he lost that ability to browse in what I call the white space between them. In fact, from the very first Smithsonian session that we had here, John Seely Brown said at one point, innovation occurs in the white spaces between disciplines. And I will tell you, that changed my life. Never saw it the same after that. Lots of places where we can dive deep into the white spaces and discover new things. Peter Block, whom I did interview, had a distinct question. Now that is an extraordinary person. Author of things like Flawless Consulting, The Answer to How Is Yes, most recently, Community Structure of Belonging. He said to me, holding ambiguity opens the mind to new insights. So learning is not just going and seeking what's there, but also giving yourself the opportunity to open yourself up to new insights. If you've been counting carefully, you know there's only six principles out there so far. The seventh one is practice. You just have to do it. I remember the first time as a manager that I had to write an evaluation for somebody. Oh my God, it was terrible. How could I evaluate somebody else's work? I mean, it's a judgment call. The first one was very painful. I've probably done hundreds since then. And now I know how to do it. And it's still a judgment call. It's still hard. But I know how to do it. So it's practice. So what I'm going to encourage you is to harness radical learning. It's social. It's sticky. It's fuel efficient. And it's
guilt-free.
Okay. Now, most speakers ask if you have any questions. I'm going to give you a question. Those of those four things, just turn to somebody and talk about which of those is the most important to you.
Guilt-free because I went back to law school at the age of 46 and graduated at the age of 50, and I too passed the bar on the same time at the first time. My Jewish mom was very proud of that. The thing for me is when I didn't also take notes, if you've taken the bar exam and you take one of these classes, one of the reasons why I didn't take notes is because everything is done for you. They hand you these outlines. And I remember the instructor saying, well, you know, we give you this because we think that people are enormously bad at taking notes. So we give you this, everything is done for you, not, you know, just sat back and listened. And again, it's more expansionship than it is, you know, learning-wise. I mean, it's really learning how to take an exam, learning how to be tested, which is what bar exam is all about. So that's what it did for me.
Okay, and for that first volunteer, you get a copy.
Oh, great, I have to read it now.
Speaking of having somebody else read for you, though, there is a colleague in this room over there, and one other colleague, three of us. We have a book club. We each read a different book on the same topic. Okay? Okay? And about once a month, we teleconference. That's all. And we talk for an hour. Fabulous. That is efficient. Okay.
little repeat, but I put guilt-free because I put just about all the others under that. It covers them all.
It covers them all. You know, and that's why I really put it in there, because so often when I work with people, they're worried because they don't know everything. It's impossible. In 1990, you were able to hold 80% of the knowledge you needed to do your job in your head. Today, it's only 8%. And it's not because our minds have less capacity. It's because there's so much more demanded of us. Okay? So, get rid of the guilt. How about another comment? Yes.
Jessica and I actually both thought that social was at the top of the list, and for one reason it feeds the other one. So being able to have some exchange lessens the overwhelm of that having to read all these books or periodicals because you just got it in a few minutes from somebody. And it also seems to stick better. You know, listening to somebody give you their insights on the premise of a book or an article seems to stick often better than reading the whole passage.
That's right. You can ask a question online. They'll give you a story. You can stick even further and you've got context around it. Yeah. One more. Yes.
I agree with what you said on social and our discussion. I'm also a lawyer, and I didn't take notes for the 2.5 years I went to law school. I'm not finding
the theme here.
First year, because it's Socratic and you have a conversation. And I think it's just hearing that and then having a discussion is really a good way to learn it all. And like you said, the others fall under because then it sticks for me. And I obviously have no guilt problems.
Well, it's a great story that comes from a friend of mine who taught at American University for many years. And she said one time she came to her class and she said, now, everything is on the PowerPoint and you're going to get copies of the PowerPoint so you don't have to take notes. So she began her lecture and somebody's taking notes. And she said again, you don't have to take notes, you're going to get the copies of the notes. Continued to take notes. And finally she said, you're going to get the notes. And he said, I'm not taking notes of what you're saying. I'm taking the notes of what I'm thinking about
as you're talking.
Right.
And that's what
she said, changed her whole perspective on that. Yeah. Okay, let me open it to your questions to you, from me.
Right.
Any questions? Are we so clear?
Real deep learning comes from practice and experience.
Okay.
And that's a real rate limiter. So how do you incorporate that background? Just apply it to
different backgrounds. Yes. In fact, Jeff Holman has a great book out called Talent is Overrated.
Yep.
And he talks about the fact that people who are world-class in areas, do deep practice. And the deep practice, by the way, is not just doing it over and over and over again. It's doing it on the edge of your capacity, which is why athletes always need a coach, because you're always on the edge of the capacity. And the second is deep knowledge. And in fact, the people that I interviewed who were able to jump out of their boundary and into the pure white spaces, like Peter Block, Ralph Brazo, Pedro, Claudia Lamoureux was another one of those. Those people were able to do it because they had a deep reservoir of knowledge in their own ears. And it was like a lifeline that kept them as capable of handling this paradox that they were suddenly thrown into. The message of the book, part of the message of the book, is a lot of how-to, but what I hope comes through is that you rise the current. And only at times do you make a decision to dive deep. And that's your decision to dive deep. Yes. Thank you, Jeff. What's your next?
From the interviews, what did you learn from the 17-year-old and from the 80-year-old?
Okay. The 17-year-old said to me, oh, Mallow, what I want to do, because I always ask everybody, what are your three wishes? You could stay for an hour. She said, I want to be able to put my head on a book and know everything in it and remember it. The 82-year-old said, a hardened mind is the worst thing that you can have. A hardened mind is the worst thing you can have. This is a man, 82, who was writing a book on the ukulele. It was published posthumously, right after his death. He just got mentioned. Yeah. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, then I'm going to say a few things. I'm going to take advantage. If you're curious about how to do this, I know that the stories that I told you gave you some ideas. But tomorrow, in the conference on Saturday at George Mason University, which you're invited to, very reasonable wait to come in the door, I will be doing a session on one of many, many sessions that will be going on. I'll be doing one on that. What else was I going to tell you? I think maybe that's it. That was the most important thing. So thank you.
Thanks very much, Simon. Let's take a 20-minute break. We're going to go.